Hello, neighbors. Welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Impey, your host. This is the show about food, where we hear from farmers, thinkers, promoters, chefs, processors, and visionaries. And sometimes all of these roles are combined in the same person. Today is no exception to that. I'll be speaking with a chef who has come to be known not just for his culinary skills, but also for his holistic approach to our culture and our food.
Sharing food with someone is, like, you know, next to making love, is the most intimate thing that you do. It's a very intimate interaction. It's a very personal interaction. Cooking for someone is a great act of love. As a society, we're far more disconnected from our actual food than we've ever been.
Despite the many times I make fun of town, I do like St. John's. There are pockets of the city that fascinate, that stand still, as it were, that capture a time and a place and a way of life. Kitty-Vitty Village is one such neighborhood. I drive in on a mozzy morning, waiting my turn on the curve where the road narrows to Wadden Lane. I'm here to talk to a person who is known for both his food preparation skills as well as his keen observations of our food history and our current food trajectories. In speaking out, he's helped to put a number of important items on our collective menus. The restaurant is bustling, even at this time of day. Let's go across to the inn to find a quieter space. Join us.
I'm Todd Perrin, and we're at Mallard Cottage in Kitty-Vitty Village.
Do you remember when you decided that being a chef would be your life?
I mean, I remember pretty well deciding when I was going to go to cooking school.
Yeah.
But I don't think even then I realized kind of how it was all going to play out. It was mostly after being a failed university student and kind of not certain what I was going to do very much. And cooking was something I enjoyed. So I kind of, through the encouragement of some friends and family, I decided to go to cooking school. And so I kind of did it. And luckily for me, I did, because I guess it turned out to be something that I liked enough to keep doing. You know?
That's why we fail some university students. So they do useful things with their life.
Well, you know what? Honestly, I don't know if typical is the word, but I was a very good student in school, and I was like top of my class, and I was, all of my high school teachers thought I was going to go on to be a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, something like that. And I got in university, and I just didn't like any of the things that were in front of me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just didn't apply myself in any way.
Yeah. Do you remember things that you never thought would be useful to you that became useful?
I think one of the secrets, if not as a secret, but one of the things that makes me, you know, half decent at what I'm doing here is that I still have a bit of a foot in the traditional way that Newfoundlanders grew up, in the sense that I can do a little bit of carpentry, I can do a little bit of plumbing, I can do a little bit of electrical, I'm a little bit handy. And I'm able to do a lot of those things around a restaurant that a lot of people can't do. Yeah. So in terms of a restaurant environment, it makes a big difference if you don't have to call somebody every time a doorknob falls off or if you want to change something, because our margins are so slim that it's cheaper for me to hire an extra cook and for me to be the handyman than it is for me to have a tradesman coming in all the time. Yeah. My first job, my chef was English, and he's, you know, 10, 15 years older than me. And when he went to culinary school in the UK, that was part of their training. Part of their training was basic plumbing, basic electrical, just so you knew how to fix the things in the restaurant when they broke. And it wasn't as much about a financial thing, but it was just like if a pipe falls off a sink in the middle of a service, well, you can't wait for a plumber to get there. You know, someone has to be able to deal with it, right?
So that attitude about do-it-yourself and so on has, I think, rolled over into your menu and how you get your food and so on and so forth. You want to talk a little bit about how you're recovering some of the more traditional food ways in Newfoundland Labrador, or trying to?
Well, I think our idea from the beginning was that a couple things. One was we wanted to highlight Newfoundland and Labrador, because we see that as a much stronger story than the story of Mallard Cottage or the story of Todd Perrin or Stephen Lee or whoever. Like, it's kind of like we saw telling the story of our place as a bigger opportunity than telling the story of, you know, an individual cook or a restaurant owner. Yeah. So, you know, the story of Newfoundland, the land and its food and the place was something that we thought was important to weave into what we're trying to do. And then the other big tenant that we had was that we wanted to do whatever we wanted. So we didn't want to feel like we were having to do something because, you know, we had an investor or an overlord who, you know, decided what concept was going to be, or even the customers. Like, we really said, look, we're going to do this, and hopefully people will respond to it. And they didn't at first. When we first opened, we had to kind of change our course a little bit and kind of bob and weave a little bit until we kind of got back to what we really wanted to do, which we've been doing kind of solidly for 2.5-3 years. But the first 2 years, we dodged around trying to find where the market was going to accept us and whatnot. So, it wasn't like we opened up the door and it was a raving success from the moment we opened. Yeah. We definitely have had to tweak and work on it and kind of bring people around to, look, this is the food we're going to do, this is the style we're going to do, and in February month we got turnip, carrot, and potato. And so, you know, we'll do our best to give you that, but that's what we have because that's what is available, you know.
So you're trying to eat with the seasons as well.
Yeah, we you know, we're 90% plus local food.
Really?
So, you know, about the only thing that we have that's not local on a regular basis are things like, you know, flour and sugar and that kind of stuff, some of those staples. And we don't use any protein that's not from Newfoundland.
Really?
We're delving into a little bit of Atlantic beef lately.
Yeah.
And that's new. It's only something we've been doing in the last few months. But
what are the challenges in getting access to that?
I mean, they're many and varied, and they change all the time. So, you know, I would say that it's a combination of farmers finding their way in a kind of in the new world of chefs and restaurateurs that want to work with them. I was at a young farmers meeting symposium the other day, and they were asking us some of these same questions. And I said, you know, look, I said, you're a small local farm, but from a practical business perspective, I need you to deal with me the same way that I would deal with a large wholesaler or whatever. Like, we need to have a billing system that works. We need to have a pickup and delivery system that works. We need all of those things to work, because just like a farmer who's busy doing their thing, like, that delivery system of getting the food from them to us is where it falls down lots of times.
Yes.
We don't always have time to pick up a truck and go to the farm, which is very romantic, and it's awesome, that the vision of a chef going and walking through the field.
I've seen movies about that.
It's amazing. But, you know, from a practical perspective of a busy restaurant, it doesn't really work. The planning around trying to run a restaurant is that I need to know that I can get a product, you know, on a regular basis.
Would you ever think about Mallard Gardens or whatever, like, you'd start to grow your own?
100%.
Yeah,
I've thought about it incessantly.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other ball of wax. You know, I have a strong interest in farming and gardening, and I've been a very avid gardener, and we grow some things here. And if I wasn't a cook, I'd probably be a farmer, because I do love, I probably love that more than I actually love cooking. Like, my vision for what ultimately this will all become is a much bigger enterprise of animals, farm, a restaurant, are in the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a question of space and money, really. If I had all the money in the world, I would be doing that right now.
Yeah. So you've been doing a lot of local protein as well, and occasionally you've had hiccups around getting access to that or the processing of it and so on. Can you talk a bit about where we are as a province in terms of access to our own protein?
Well, local protein is our biggest challenge. Mm. I mean, you know, local beef is very difficult. You know, we've gotten some very good animals. We've gotten some very poor animals. Mm. The consistency is all over the map. Mm. The consistency of supply is basically what happens is very typical of a slightly underdeveloped, well, not slightly, it's quite underdeveloped protein market, is that all of the Newfoundland Labrador protein is all available in the fall, which is what people raise their animals for themselves. You'd have your animals through the spring and the summer, you slaughter it in the fall, and you preserve it or do whatever, and you'd eat it over the winter, which is great if you're homesteading.
Yeah.
But if you're a restaurateur, then I need to get lambs all year long. I need to get, you know, pigs is a bit less of an issue. We got the guys up in Point Leamington, and they're regular pig farmers, and we get pigs all year long. But basically, it's an embarrassment of riches for like 3 months a year. It's just like banging there everywhere. Everyone's trying to sell you all their lambs, trying to sell you all their stuff, and then they're gone. And, you know, like I said, the other big thing, the two big things I find with local protein is, you know, that availability piece and the timing at which is available, which is a challenge, and just the consistency of it. It's not consistent. You have three lambs come in the door. One's 36 pounds, one's 49 pounds, and one is 62 pounds. And, you know, we're able to work with that. And you know, we know that's what we're getting. So that's what it is. But, like, you know, for long-term growth and consistency of our industry, we need to achieve a level of consistency in the product that we're getting, the quality. Like, that's the one thing about us. Like, we are strongly local. We believe it and fly that flag. But we're not local for local sake. I don't buy local food that's not good. So, you know, if we have something, we've had, you know, people that we dealt with over the years that we stopped dealing with them because the quality of what we got was just not what we wanted. Buying local is about improving what we're doing, not just supporting people because they're your neighbor. I'm a big believer that in Newfoundland and Labrador, a lot of times we suffer from, that's good enough. Like, you know, we don't, what do you, like, that's good, boy, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that's a prevalent attitude. And I think that in the restaurant business, if you work like that, you're dead, period. So I think there's two things. I think personally, I'm not wired that way. And secondly, I'm in a business that I can't be like that, because if I am, then you can't survive. Restaurants don't survive by resting on their laurels. You always have to be trying to be better and fix things. And that motivates me to be calling that out when I see it. Yeah. And I think that I see that a lot in different things across the island that I deal with. And, you know, in agriculture, I see it in some of the farmers that we deal with. They're great guys, but they're doing things the same way they've done them forever, and they got no interest in changing.
Is there a piece of music I could play under this? Do you have something that you listen to, a band or a song?
Well, I'm a big, we just passed the anniversary of his death a little while ago, Ron Hines. I'm a big Ron Hines fan, so something like St. John's Waltz is a great favorite of mine. Yeah.
Oh, the harbor lights are gleaming, and the evening still and dark, and the seagulls are all dreaming, seagull dreams on Amherst Rock. And the mist is slowly drifting as the storefront lights go dim, and the moon is gently lifting as the last ship's coming in. All the sailors got a story, some are true, some are false, but they're always right, and they're up on the deck, dancing the St. John's Waltz. Oh, we've had our share of history, we've seen nations come and go, we've seen battles rage over land and stage 400 years or more. For glory or for freedom, or for country or for king, or for money or fame, but there are no names on the graves where men lie sleeping. All the 9 to 5 survive the day with the sigh and a dose of salt. They're parking their cars and packing the bars and dancing the St. John's Waltz.
I'm speaking with Todd Perrin of Mallard Cottage. His restaurant is known for seeking out and embracing many types of wild protein.
What about access to wild protein, like moose, seal?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously, you know, we're you know, the only province in Canada where we're able to do that, so we're very fortunate in that regard. Again, it's you know, it's sporadic. Like, I'm not a hunter myself, so I don't go and hunt, you know, for the restaurant myself. But you know, depending on the year, depending who's around and who's hunting, we get more moose than others. You know, we don't have regular supply, like a kind of a guy or a couple of charities we deal with, or a couple of guys will go get the license to sell, and you know they'll sell us half or whatever. So it's not super reliable. We know we're going to get game throughout the fall, but we just don't know exactly how and when. But that's fine. We can survive that. It's hard to set that up. You know, it's hard to kind of line it up. And the danger is if you know guys like me and Jeremy and other guys, if we really went at it in a way that we wanted to make it more reliable from our perspective, then you run the risk of pushing it into a commercial vein. And then that would be a problem for all of us, I think, because I think that would create a situation where people would really look at what we're doing with our with that resource.
Okay.
And the commercialization of wild food is a big controversial topic for a lot of people.
Here in Newfoundland, Labrador, it seems like there have been some other restaurants have been sort of in the forefront of the local food movement or whatever, raising it and being willing to speak out for it and talk about the quality as you've been doing here. So, is that unique in this province, or is that happening across Canada, that it's really that some restaurants are sort of leading the charge around local food and access?
No, I think, I mean, it's a trend that's been coming along for a number of years, you know, and like around North America, you know, parts of the Eastern United States, Western United States, across Canada, I think that local food and access to local food and connection between restaurants and farmers has been growing for quite a while. It's ironic, you know, as the bulk of our society becomes more and more disconnected from food, there's more conversation about food than there's ever been. So, like, you know, you got Food Network and all these people are watching TV and you know, food shows and there's conversations about food and food bloggers and blah, 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 blah. But we're, like, as a society, we're far more disconnected from our actual food than we've ever been. So I think restaurants and restaurateurs are kind of trying to be like the people are really like, oh, hold on, guys, like, you know, like, that's what a carrot looks like and whatever. Like, I think because, you know, it's good business for us to be dealing with smaller suppliers, with people that we know, having an understanding of where our food has come from. Like, I don't like the idea of relying on a huge corporate company to supply me food because they don't care about me, you know. And I, you know, we deal with a couple of the large guys for certain things that are unavoidable. That I, you know, I have to have a Cisco has to be part of my world.
Oh, my heart is on the highway, and I'm sold on going to see all the planes fill the skyway, all the trains run swift and free. So leave the wayward free to wander, leave the restless free to roam. If it's rocks in the bay, if it's old cliche, you will find your way back home. But don't question or inquire what's been gained, what's been lost. In a world of romance, don't miss out on the chance to be dancing St. John's walls.
Today I'm speaking with Todd Perrin. He takes a keen interest in the role of food in our culture and how the rise of what's often called food porn can serve to both inspire and to immobilize consumers.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was at a big bookstore recently, and I was looking at the number of shelves of cookbooks. Like, it was crazy. But I was wondering, are any of these being used? Is there sort of a food porn development here?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of food porn. I mean, the practicality, the practical piece of the book business is about the only kind of books that sell anymore are cookbooks.
Are cookbooks, really?
Yeah. Yeah. They're still a very significant part of the publishing industry.
Yeah.
I think it is the type of thing that people like to talk about food and take pictures of food and look at pictures of food, but they don't like to cook food.
Right.
It's seen as work. It has become drudgery. It has become tedious. It has become competition.
Yeah.
It has become a lot of negative things.
Yeah.
And people forget that it's the thing that sustains you on this earth. It's hard for in your day-to-day to think about that sandwich that you grab at the corner store when you're on your way to a meeting as the thing that's keeping you alive, but if it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't eat anything, you're not going to be here for very long. You know, I mean, look at this whole thing that's going on now with the E. coli. Which, my God, you can't buy romaine lettuce in North America.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole continent.
Yeah.
because of an E. coli outbreak that is down to the practices of how it's grown.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, there's just no romaine. There's like no romaine lettuce. Caesar salad is the most classic dish that there is in the world. One of the most ubiquitous in North America. And now you can't safely eat one. Why? You know, there's not 1,000 people growing romaine lettuce in North America anymore.
No.
There's 50 or whatever. I don't know what the numbers are. But the point is that, you know, every community used to have a spot where you'd go to buy romaine lettuce.
Yeah.
Now all the romaine lettuce is grown in California for everybody. Yeah. So you're eating the same romaine lettuce as a guy in Illinois is eating, as a guy in Winnipeg is eating, as a guy in Florida is eating. I mean, that is not how human beings are supposed to eat.
Yeah.
That's not how we evolved. But it is what we expect now. You expect to be able to have romaine lettuce whenever you want it. You expect to have strawberries whenever you want them.
Avocados year-round.
Avocados year-round. And you know, that means that somebody has to manipulate the system because there's no other way to provide that for everybody. Like I said, if you look at the healthcare costs and, you know, the issues that we have, the sustainability of our island, the first step towards our island becoming more economically sustainable is being food sustainable. Mm-hmm. They're hand in hand, they're part and parcel. It's talked about as, oh, you know, it'd be great to be able to go down to the farmer's market and buy more food.
Right.
No, it's not, wouldn't be great. It's imperative. We need to be able to do that. Because getting in and out of Newfoundland and Labrador, even though we're in 2019 now almost, or whatever it is, it's not getting easier to get here.
Yeah.
You know, our connection across the Gulf, that's not getting simpler.
Yeah.
You know, like that with changing climate and stuff. I mean, you know, and I'm sure, I think the statistics from the ferry guys would be a bit different, but I mean, it seems to me that just constantly the ferry doesn't run.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, you know, we're always getting pinched off all the time. I mean, we all know what's going on with flights. I mean, there's not much food flying in here anyway, but it's like, you know, with flights and stuff. So, I mean, we're becoming, in many ways, we're becoming more isolated than we've ever been. And when we were completely isolated, we were self-sustainable. But now we're not self-sustainable because we became connected to Canada and people burned their boats and people tore up their gardens and all this kind of stuff. And now, you know, we're reliant on these things and we got no other means to look after ourselves. And do you think that who's running to our aid? No one. We always grew our own food, Ivan.
Yeah.
I mean, when did significant tonnages of food start getting imported in Newfoundland and Labrador?
Yeah.
So it's only a generation and a half, two generations.
Yeah.
Like when my dad grew up, my dad didn't go to the supermarket and buy food that came from Nova Scotia. No one did. I'm very passionate about this. I believe this very strongly. I don't always do enough to actually change it. You know, I am a fellow who likes to talk about it, and sometimes I feel like I don't do enough to change it. We are, that's what annoys me a lot about our situation that we're in now. Is that we're not that far away from the time when we looked after ourselves. We fed ourselves, you know, we took care of those things and we didn't complain about it. And now we're reliant on that transport truck coming from somewhere.
Yeah.
And the question has to be why? People say, oh, you can't grow food, it's a rock, it's too hard to grow food there, you can't. It's not true. That's patently not true. Is it more difficult? Probably.
Leave the wayward, free the wanderer. Leave the restless, free to roam. If it's rocks in the bay, if it's old cliche, you will find your way back home. But don't question or inquire what's been gained, what's been lost. In a world of romance, don't miss out on the chance to be dancing St. John's waltz. Yeah, but they're always wrecked, and they're up on the deck, and dancing the St. John's waltz.
On today's show, I'm speaking with Todd Perrin, widely known as a founder and chef at Mallard Cottage in the Kitivitty Village neighborhood of St. John's. We begin this last section on his level of optimism for the future of food.
You know, I'm an eternal optimist, but I'm also practical in the sense that I appreciate that most people don't care. There's a reason why, you know, we have the most successful restaurant chains in the world are these fast food chains. And, and you know, convenience food has never been, you know, a bigger part of our diet and all that kind of stuff. Is that people, it's not prioritized for people. I shouldn't say people don't care. That makes it sound like people are, you know, being callous to it. It's not a priority. You know, I grew up in a house where we sat around the table and had supper. And that was a thing. We didn't do it every night. And, you know, but having a meal at least a couple days, a few days a week together, all of us, that was cooked, was something that we did. And not because it was an effort to hold on or reclaim something. It was because that's what you do. You know, like I say, I said before, sharing food with someone is like, you know, next to making love is the most intimate thing that you do. Mm-hmm. It's a very intimate interaction. Mm-hmm. It's a very personal interaction. Cooking for someone is a great act of love. You know, sitting around a table with someone. I mean, it's where important family decisions get made. It is the catalyst for so much of our socialization as human beings. And think about how often you eat in your car by yourself. And so, you know, what does that achieve? Yeah. Nothing. Those things don't move our society forward in any way. They, in fact, move our society backwards because it's making you sicker. It's making you less connected with people. You know, I'm guilty of it as anybody. But I've, in the last year or 6 months, I've made those one decision I made in the last little bit of a kind of try to get my life a bit more in order is a simple thing. I don't eat my car anymore. And just that alone has made me feel healthier, has made me feel a little more socially connected. There's nothing sadder than eating by yourself. It has real social impacts. I mean, some of the work that is happening with some of these great groups like The Gathering Place that we're involved with, and a lot of what they talk about is not only about providing a good quality meal to someone but who needs it. It's providing a good quality meal to someone with dignity in an environment that they feel safe with other people that they can talk to and relate to and share. And that's being so lost in our society. And it's really the building block of a healthy culture. And I think that you can't overstate it. You know, it sounds dramatic and people are going to listen and be like, oh God, listen to that guy. But, you know, I mean, I really believe it. I believe that. Because I've seen how it's changed in 25 years in the restaurant business. You know, our industry has changed dramatically. Restaurants were places where families came, business associates came, you sat down, you enjoyed yourself, you had a nice bottle of wine, you enjoyed a meal. It was, you were going out to have fun. Now, you're going out because you're trying to achieve something, or you're going out because you heard about a place that you gotta go to, or you wanna take a picture, or you wanna write a blog and critique it, right? As opposed to going out to have a nice meal.
What's your favorite local food? That might be hard, but you have many, so many, but what's...
Chanterelle mushrooms, I think.
Chanterelles? Okay.
Yeah, chanterelles are something that I've always loved, and I worked in Switzerland for a while, and the mushrooms was a big part of what we did in the fall over there, and the chanterelles were one of them, and so I became a very big fan of just chanterelles and garlic shallots and white wine and just eat a bowl of mushrooms. The fact that we have some of the best chanterelles around here is a bonus. So chanterelles, I think. Cod, obviously. Yeah. Fresh, piece of fresh cod. You can't beat it.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of favorites when it comes to local. Mackerel. Mackerel's a big favorite of mine.
It's great. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, pleasure.
I bid goodbye to Todd. I drive out of the village with my mind buzzing. Can we make some of these changes to truly honor food and the role it plays in our lives and our culture? This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. If you have questions or comments, email me at fittoeatnl, one word, at gmail.com. To listen to other episodes or for more information, go to www.fittoeatnl.ca. The music for today's show was St. John's Waltz by Ron Hines, as requested by Todd Perrin. The theme music, Cluck Old Hen, was done this week by The Renegades. This is a production of Kitchen Table Communications with the support of the Newfoundland Labrador Federation of Agriculture and Food First NL. I'm Ivan Emke. Join me again next time take care of each other. And the best way to do that? Cook for each other, share food, eat together. Happy trails.
That's what annoys me a lot about our situation that we're in now, is that we're not that far away from the time when we looked after ourselves.